So October 5th was kind of an interesting day for us, as you've pointed out. I was in the hospital hanging out with my brand new kid, and then right after that you sent me an email and you said, we're working on this project, and as it so happens, I've just had some life changes too. And so it's just really interesting timing because we're getting into this project and like we're both kind of thinking about life in new and different ways.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What's going on?
Well, so the day your baby was born, I started taking SSRIs, which is the acronym for Selective Serotonin Reuptake Inhibitor, which is a kind of antidepressant. My name is Caroline Leland. For the past 2.5 years, I experienced mild but chronic depressive symptoms. This show is not about me, but as the series host, I want to start by briefly sharing my personal connection to the topic we're about to dive into. I'm a journalist, so I was honestly excited to be researching for work, something I was simultaneously dealing with certain aspects of in my personal life. Now, I'm using my personal experience to help define this disease we're talking about and to set the stage for the health story of the woman we will be featuring throughout this series. We're starting here at Chapter 1, Defining Depression. On October 5th, 2017, I started taking antidepressant medication. It took me a long time to make that decision because I knew I didn't have clinical depression, formerly known as major depressive disorder. I took an abnormal psychology class in college, and I knew major depressive disorder was defined by a set of criteria which I did not fully meet. To be diagnosed with MDD, you need to have experienced at least 2 weeks of a major depressive episode, which causes significant distress or disability, that is, difficulty performing normal day-to-day functions. Actually, that's pretty much the definition of a mental illness in general. An internal experience that causes significant distress or impairment in social, occupational, or other important areas of functioning. According to the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual for Psychology, usually just called the DSM, someone with depression exhibits 5 or more of the following symptoms during the same 2-week period. Get ready, because there is a menu of 9 options. Number 1, depressed mood. Number 2, markedly diminished interest or pleasure in all or almost all activities. Number 3, significant weight loss when not dieting or weight gain, or decrease or increase in appetite. Number 4, insomnia or hypersomnia. Number 5, psychomotor agitation or retardation, which is more than just feeling hyperactive or feeling like you don't have energy. It's your body actually moving too much or not moving in a strange way. Number 6 is fatigue or loss of energy, and that's one that's hard to measure, but it has to be an extreme enough level. Number 7, feelings of worthlessness or excessive or inappropriate guilt, not merely self-reproach or guilt about being sick. Number 8, diminished ability to think or concentrate or indecisiveness, another one that's really hard to measure and seems almost normal, but in this case is to an extreme, obviously. And finally, number 9, recurrent thoughts of death, not just fear of dying, recurrent suicidal ideation with or without a specific plan, or a suicide attempt. Did I have depression? I had 2 or 3 of the 5 symptoms required to be diagnosed with MDD. I had a depressed mood most of the day, nearly every day, though I was often able to ignore it or pretend I wasn't sad. I still took pleasure from things like eating and running, things I've always loved and still was able to enjoy to some extent. I didn't lose or gain weight. I sometimes slept too much, but not nearly every day for a 2-week period. I definitely didn't have psychomotor agitation or retardation. I definitely did go through long stretches of feeling very tired all the time for no good reason, and I did not feel worthless, though I definitely felt guilty for my unhappiness. I was miserable, but not suicidal. I knew I didn't have MDD, so I thought I didn't deserve or qualify for any kind of special treatment. I thought I had an attitude problem. I saw myself as an ungrateful brat who deserved my own unhappiness. In July of 2017, I hired a personal development coach to help me work through this negative attitude. And side note, remember that idea. This isn't the last time we'll hear from someone dealing with that internal feeling of self-blame and general guilt. After a couple of months of me crying to this coach via our weekly Skype sessions, she finally recommended that I, quote, cast a wider net in terms of finding solutions to my issues. 2 days later, I walked into a clinic, and the following week, I had started a daily dosage of an antidepressant pill called citalopram, or Celexa. Around that time, I was breaking down into tears every single day. The medicine took about a month to take effect, and it started working gradually, but it did work. I don't cry every day anymore. I still have moments of frustration, disappointment, grief, pain, but they aren't my default feelings. They aren't my baseline. Finally, I'm able to wake up looking forward to what the day might bring me instead of wishing I could sleep through my life. Finally, I can feel vague hope about the future instead of a baseless, crushing despair. The prospects of my future haven't changed. My future isn't any more clear to me, but the medication helps my brain process its mood-stabilizing chemical, serotonin, more effectively. This is what depression looks like for me. Toward the end of October, my colleague David Schifrin and I sat down to talk through this experience and how it relates to my work with health further, specifically to the podcast series you're listening to right now, Contributing Factors Season 1. You heard the first bit of that conversation at the beginning of this episode. Here are a couple more minutes of that discussion that helps set up the story. You can hear the full conversation as a bonus episode of Contributing Factors. It being relevant to the work we were doing, I did feel like it was important to be open about it. And like you said, it's like a big deal, but also not a big deal. And that was something I felt very strongly when I was deciding to start medication. The tension there was why I chose to be more public about it, because I didn't want it to feel like this big secret, something embarrassing, a sign of weakness or anything like that. I wanted to take action and being public about that decision. And so to prove to myself that I shouldn't feel ashamed about it, I decided to be super public about it and post it on Facebook, where anyone who knew me personally would know, because to me that action was like a reaction against my initial reaction of embarrassment. And so by being more public about it, to me, that was me putting a stake in the ground or whatever and saying, I claim this as something that I'm not ashamed of. So that's a little piece of my story, and it's part of why I'm excited to be working on this project. More broadly, though, we're doing this series because we are Health Further, and we want to talk about health systems and how to make them better. The series is called Contributing Factors because we want to look not just at the problems, but at the systems, institutions, and solutions that surround them. We're doing Season 1 about depression because we think mental health needs more attention. Also, it sits right at that intersection of so many components of our health system, so in many ways it's emblematic of how we as a society handle health in all of the different factors and industry sectors that are involved. This is Episode 1, your introduction to the series. Episode 2 covers the clinical and biological aspects of depression. Episode 3 covers social context. Episode 4 addresses the healthcare system as a whole. And Episode 5 focuses on business and innovation. In Episode 6, we highlight listener feedback, go over what we missed, and give you a preview of our next season of Contributing Factors. For the sake of organizing such a gargantuan topic, these 6 episodes are divided into 20 chapters total. Quick disclaimer that we discuss a variety of health topics in this series and health science, but we are not in any way or at any time offering medical advice. We are not medical professionals. If you have medical questions or concerns, contact a healthcare provider. Secondly, we want to be comprehensive, but we know there's no way we've done that perfectly. While we've done our best to include as many voices as possible, there will certainly be differing opinions to what many of our interviewees say. For this series, we're not trying to present a final version of depression, but to tell a story that gives as much context as possible. We welcome the feedback of you, our listeners. Please disagree, give us constructive criticism, push back where you think we need it. Email David at healthfurther.com or tweet at us at healthfurther. So finally, here we are in Episode 1. What is depression and why does it matter? You heard me explain the clinical definition of major depressive disorder at the beginning of this episode. Some people think that definition is too narrow. Some think it's too broad. One thing I didn't fully realize before last year was that subclinical depressive symptoms, that is, meeting some but not all of the criteria for MDD, is still a legitimate experience deserving of appropriate treatment. But a scientific field has to have an agreed-upon definition of a disease, something measurable and standardized, so thus we have the DSM and its official definitions of mental illnesses. Here is Nashville-based psychiatric nurse practitioner Mary Carter to explain depression in her words.
neurotransmitters in our brain are truly brain chemicals that support our mood. It's one of their numerous functions, but one of those functions is to support our mood or keep it in a what we consider euthymic place where we can experience sadness, we can experience joy, we can experience anxiety, and all those emotions serve us in some way, but they are transient. So major depressive disorder, the biology in our brain is actually staying stuck in a depressed place.
Chapter 2. This is what it feels like. I told you what I experienced, and that's called mild depression or mild depressive symptoms. What does full-blown major depressive disorder feel like? I asked Lucero Cifuentes, a 24-year-old woman who we're featuring throughout this season of Contributing Factors.
I would often find myself in the fetal position, like on the floor, and just wanting to die, really. There would be times where I would just, this is really, and it's scary to think about it, but I would daydream about being hit by a bus, or like, sometimes I would be crossing the street and I was like, what would happen if I just, you know, took a step? The biggest thing with depression is helplessness. You get into this point of despair where you just want to escape your body because there's such an overwhelming feeling of, I would either feel nothing or just extreme sadness, where there would be times where I would just cry a lot and sleep all day, and then there would be other times where I couldn't sleep at all. My depression, it would be a combination of me overthinking everything, overanalyzing, over just thinking, couldn't stop the thinking, couldn't sleep, had bad insomnia because I was thinking, and just there's these ruminating thoughts constantly, like just walking down the street with your friends, even having a good time, and then this thought pops in your head like, wow, I really hate you. Like your mind talking to yourself, like, why do you exist? This big misconception is people are just like, snap out of it, get out of bed, do something you love, and you'll be fine. Like, just deal with it. And it's not like that. You can't do that. If I could do that, I'd do it right now. But it's just this overwhelming helplessness where you can't. And that's what's so frustrating, because I want to be happy. Of course I want to be happy. Who doesn't want to be happy? No one knowingly says, oh, I think I'll be depressed today. There's a difference between feeling sorry for yourself, which a lot of people think of people with depression, and having a clinical issue where you literally can't control how you feel. And my friends still say, I will never understand how you actually feel. But they're learning to understand it. It's not me being childish or anything like that. It's me just literally not being able to control the overwhelming like nothingness or sadness that I feel on a day-to-day basis. The idea of happiness always made me angry. Like when people would say, I'm happy. I could never say that. It made me angry, this idea of people being happy, because I didn't understand what it was. I knew what it was to be less depressed than usual, like, or like not to the point where I was just in my bed all day, but I didn't know what happiness was. That's still an issue, the word happy, that bothers me, because I guess it is different for everyone, but I can get enjoyment out of things.
I asked Cifuentes how she got through school. How did she graduate from high school, let alone a prestigious college like the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, when she was battling these overwhelming emotions of despair every moment of every day?
I don't know how I did. I think, a lot of times I'd find myself and I'm like, wow, I'm here. How did I get here? Like, just looking back, I'm pretty proud that I was actually able to finish university on time. High school was torturous, and I was obsessed with perfect attendance, and I had perfect attendance all through high school, but I just was not sleeping very much because I would have breakdowns, or I would like get around the system where I'm like, I'll just go half the day and then I would leave the other half because I couldn't deal with it anymore. A lot of days I thought I couldn't make it. I would have a breakdown almost every day in the car on the way to school, where I would yell at my mom to turn around, take me back. But I still ended up there. And university, I don't know. I really don't know. Some of my teachers were aware because in the classes where attendance wasn't required, I just wouldn't go. And I somehow managed to like slide by. I managed to get by, but it was miserable. I couldn't study and I didn't study because my negative, like depressed thoughts were so consuming that I couldn't even read two lines. I just feel like I was cheated by my depression and that I wasn't able to achieve the things that I wanted to. At the time, I thought it was because I was worthless and I couldn't, but now I'm like, I know I could have, and I had to deal with so much that honestly, I mean, I am kind of proud of myself that I even made it through university.
Chapter 3, Why It Matters. As incredible as her story is, Cifuentes isn't totally unique in this experience. 1 in 5 adults experience mental illness in a given year. That's double the percent of adult Americans with diabetes. In theory, you could think about the number of people you know with diabetes and then assume you know twice as many people with a mental illness. In a given year, 1 in 25 adults in the U.S. experience a serious mental illness that substantially interferes with major life activities. That's more than double the number of Americans with red hair. In theory, you could think about the number of people you know with red hair and then assume you know twice as many people with a severe mental illness. More Americans suffer from severe depression than the populations of New York City, Los Angeles, and Chicago combined. Those are the 3 biggest cities in the U.S. As you might guess, it's even more prevalent in rough environments. And on top of that, fewer than half of people with a mental health condition, regardless of their situation, actually get professional help for it. As someone who really dragged my feet on starting antidepressant medication when I needed it, I can attest to the lack of general cultural awareness that might otherwise lead someone to seek medical help when it's needed for a mental health issue. This matters for more than preventing human misery. Our whole society is impacted by the economic fallout from mental illnesses like depression. Depression can result in lower educational attainment, lower earning potential, increased chance of teenage childbearing, marital instability, higher unemployment, and increased work disability. Depression is the leading cause of disability worldwide and a major contributor to other diseases. A study by the World Health Organization found that serious mental illness costs the global economy $1 trillion in lost productivity each year. And depression is a lethal disease. 90% of those who die by suicide have an underlying mental illness. And suicide is the 10th leading cause of death in the U.S. Gastonia, North Carolina-based clinical social worker Hannah Sani, whom you'll hear more from in future episodes, faces this reality every day.
Depression in its most severe form can cause death. It is lethal. Just like many other chronic diseases, it takes down that self-preservation part of your brain.
Cifuentes has survived her depression thus far. Many of us know people who didn't. That's why all of this matters, because depression is a horrible disease that strips people of the will to live. It causes disability and is detrimental to our economy, but ultimately it matters because it causes avoidable misery. As we'll discuss in upcoming episodes, our medical and political systems don't have perfect solutions. But there are some solutions, and they're often underutilized. We produced this series to bring those solutions to light in the hopes that open discussion about this topic will accelerate the development of new and better solutions. In the meanwhile, here's a final word of hope and strength from Lucero Cifuentes, explaining why she chose radical vulnerability in sharing her story for this podcast project.
I have a different perspective from what I've dealt with. In a way, I wouldn't change it. Like, I know it was awful, and I say that now because I'm out of it. Like, out of the worst part of my life. I hope. but I know it shaped me in a way that I'm able to empathize with people in a way that other people can't. The more open I've become about my struggle with mental illness, the more I've met other people that have dealt with it. And like with DACA.
That is Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, President Obama's executive order to protect undocumented immigrants who were brought to the U.S. as children.
You talk about people coming out of the shadows. And I think almost it's coming out of the shadows as well when you talk about mental illness, because a lot of people keep it to themselves. But then when you do come out of the shadows, you finally have this alliance, this network of people that you're like, oh, someone finally gets me. And just knowing that you're not alone, although like you're all struggling, it's just a beautiful thing to know that you're not alone in any way. And to know that there are organizations that are starting to talk about it and are starting to promote mental health awareness. Having a platform to share your story is crucial. Being able to finally be able to confide in other people, because I think more than a therapist, sharing stories with other people who've dealt with the same thing has been more helpful, and having people understand the way you think. And as far as the health system getting better, I feel like it is so much is based on awareness.
Now, a sneak preview of our next episode.
We're increasingly understanding that changes occur in depression throughout the brain, and this makes it a very complicated disorder, both to pinpoint exact places within the brain where the key changes are occurring, and also to remind us that depression is both a mood disorder and a thought disorder.
The one frustrating thing in mental health, as opposed to other fields of medicine, is that we can't draw levels of serotonin and check your blood work and see how low a person's serotonin is, or norepinephrine or dopamine, whatever it might be. We're so often saying to a person, your symptoms outwardly really indicate that your brain chemistry is not well regulated right now. That's our best hypothesis, and there's no way to confirm that necessarily without some really extensive testing that would be unnecessary.
More on that in our next episode, where we'll talk about the biological, genetic, and clinical aspects of depression. Contributing Factors is hosted by me, Caroline Leland. I also wrote, edited, and produced this series. David Schifrin is our executive producer, Stephanie Edwards is our music supervisor, Matt Faulkner leads marketing, and additional creative assistance is provided by Michaela Powell. Our original theme music is written and performed by Matt Phillips. Be sure to check him out at ilikemattphillips.com. That's Matt with two T's and Phillips with two L's. Thanks also to Matt Faulkner for going the extra mile and helping us perfect this episode. Special thanks to Lucero Cifuentes for allowing us to share her story. Many thanks also to Mary Carter and Hannah Sani, whose voices appear briefly in this episode. You'll hear more from them in later episodes. Contributing Factors is a Health Further production. You can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, and Google Play. For bonus content from this episode, go to healthfurther.com/contributing-factors. While you're there, you can learn more about Health Further and everything we have going on. You can also find us on Twitter at Health Further. Please take a minute to rate and review Contributing Factors on Apple Podcasts, and then share it with your community. Your participation and support is what makes this show succeed, so thank you for being here and for helping spread the word. Join us next week as we look at the clinical and biological contexts of depression.